Reading from the Epistle of Paul to the Ephesians, chapter 5. Be ye therefore followers of God as dear children, and walk in love, as Christ also hath loved us, and hath given himself for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling savor. But fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not be once named among you, as becometh saints. Neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor jesting, which are not convenient, but rather giving of thanks. For this ye know, that no whoremonger, nor unclean person, nor covetous man, who is an idolater, hath any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. Let no man deceive you with vain words, for because of these things cometh the wrath of God upon the children of disobedience. Be not ye therefore partakers with them. For ye were sometimes darkness, but now are ye light in the Lord. Walk as children of light, for the fruit of the Spirit is in all goodness and righteousness and truth, proving what is acceptable unto the Lord. And have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather reprove them. For it is a shame even to speak of those things which are done of them in secret. But all things that are reproved are made manifest by the light. For whatsoever doth make manifest is light. Wherefore he saith, Awake, thou that sleepest, and arise from the dead, and Christ shall give thee light. See then that ye walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. Wherefore, be ye not unwise, but understanding what the will of the Lord is. And be not drunk with wine wherein is excess, but be filled with the Spirit, speaking to yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord, giving thanks always for all things unto God and the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, submitting yourselves one to another in the fear of God. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, as the church is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife, even as himself, and the wife see that she reverence her husband.
Great, thank you. We spent some time this morning considering the importance, the spiritual significance of marriage between a brother and a sister. We tried to point out it's not simply a matter of convenience or a choice that you make out of some binding or blinding love for another. Marriage is a high ideal that God calls us to. God does so for our own good, knowing that it's a great medium for one person to help another become the kind of person that God wants us to be, a godly seed. But few of the things that we hold in such high regard are so poorly understood. It struck me as I was preparing these classes how often marriage is the topic of our classes in education, and how much we know about the concept of marriage, and how little of it we actually practice in everyday life. Or rather, let's be honest, it struck me personally, as I was preparing the classes, how much I know about marriage academically, and how little I actually put into practice what I know. Because that's the point of all Bible study. It's the point of all education, is for us to change our behavior, to do what we read. We all know what's right and wrong. We all know how to properly treat and respect your spouses. You've heard a lot of the things I'm going to say this afternoon before. But when you've been working hard all week and you face some serious issues at work that day and you come home to relax only to find out that your spouse has overdrawn the checkbook again, it's really hard to put what you know into action and to respond in the most Christ-like manner possible. So our goal in this class is just to simply remind everybody about some helpful hints in keeping a marriage happy, keeping a marriage working, in hopes that consistent, continual reminders will eventually assimilate into our brains and ultimately affect our behavior. So as we consider what is required of us to make complete our vows, to build divorce-resistant marriages, it often comes down to just a few things and actually doing them. Not just knowing them, not just, you know, reading about it or understanding or even making notes in your margin, but actually doing it on Tuesday night at 7:30. Thankfully, the Scriptures aren't silent on the issue. We get much good advice and help found in the Scriptures on the topic of marriage. One of my favorites comes from Ephesians, the chapter we just read, and I believe it really comes to life in this modern version. Verse 22 says, "Wives, understand and support your husbands in ways that show your support for Christ." I think that really puts a fine point to it. You aren't doing this because he deserves it. You're supporting your husband because that is how you show your support for Christ. So keep that in mind. It would be great if your husband was such a wonderful, caring, and considerate person that you were moved and compelled to show him understanding and support. But even when he's not, the love and the commitment you have for Jesus needs to compel you to be faithful and true to your vows. Remember that the vow you've taken is a symbol of your commitment to Christ. And reflect that commitment in your service to your husband. And the husband also has quite a role to fill. It continues on in verse 23, and it says, "The husband provides leadership to his wife the way Christ does to his church. Not by domineering, but by cherishing." So just as the ecclesia submits to Christ as he exercises such leadership, wives should likewise submit to their husbands. Not by domineering, but by cherishing. The husband needs to lead his family, but he does so because he loves them and he wants the best for them. Look at the commandment to the husband in verse 25. "Husbands, go all out in your love for your wives, exactly as Christ did for the church. A love marked by giving, not getting." Go all out in your love for your wife. I like how he says that the love of Christ for the ecclesia and the love of a husband for his wife is a love marked by giving, and giving, and giving, and giving, and giving. Not receiving. Paul continues to explain what he means in verse 25. He says, "Christ's love makes the church whole. His words evoke her beauty. Everything he does and says is designed to bring out the best in her, dressing her in dazzling white silk, radiant with holiness." And that is how husbands ought to love their wives. Men, consider this your example in your treatment of your wife. Your words should evoke her beauty. Dressing her in dazzling white silk, radiant with holiness, not tearing down, but building up. It makes sense because it is your wife we're talking about. That's what he says in verse 28. They're really doing themselves a favor since they're already one in marriage. No one abuses his own body, does he? No, he feeds it and pampers it. And that's how Christ treats us, his ecclesia, since we are part of his body. Commit yourself wholly to the fact that this is going to be your one and only wife. And you'll be much more interested in taking care of her and building her up so that she's the best that she can be. Paul continues in verse 31. He says, "And this is why a man leaves father and mother and cherishes his wife. No longer two, they become one flesh. This is a huge mystery, and I don't pretend to understand it at all. What is clearest to me is the way that Christ treats the ecclesia." Paul admits what men have known for thousands of years. Marriage is a huge mystery. We're going to keep coming back to this verse again today and again tomorrow. Because I think that's important for us to kind of remember. You know, Paul, as wise as he was and as much as he was able to teach us and instruct us, he admits this is a huge mystery. You look that word up, it is exactly what you imagine it to be. It's a mysterious and a secretive thing. Beware the man who claims to understand it. It's a complex and confusing relationship. For a man to understand a woman, or a woman for that matter, to understand a man, is almost impossible. It can be wonderful, rewarding, and fulfilling, agreed. But it's an extremely complicated, multifaceted, most human of all relationships. And the only one clear thing is the way that Christ treats the ecclesia. That's our goal and that's our guide. Verse 33 says, This provides a good picture of how each husband is to treat his wife, loving himself and loving her, and how each wife is to honor her husband. So if you get confused about how to act, we turn to this question that often helps us in times of confusion. What would Jesus do? How do I decide what the best road to take is as a husband or as a wife? It's confusing, we agree. But the one thing we know is it's an example of how Christ loved his ecclesia. So I want to consider some of the essentials of a healthy marriage. I want to ask ourselves, what would Jesus do? And let's apply ourselves to determining what is the Christ-like way for us to act. A healthy marriage takes effort and energy. It doesn't just happen. Just because you're both baptized doesn't ensure you're going to have a healthy marriage. You have to work at it. And like all living, growing organisms, you need to cultivate it, adding nutrients and water, time and attention. I want to talk this morning about the seven essentials to a healthy marriage. Number one, a healthy expectation of what marriage should be. Number two, a realistic understanding of love. Number three, a positive attitude and outlook toward life. Number four, the ability to communicate feelings. Number five, an understanding and acceptance of gender differences. Number six, the ability to make decisions and settle arguments. And number seven, a common spiritual foundation and goal. When we talk about a healthy expectation of what marriage is, that's the very first thing you really need to come to. And even if you've been married many years, it doesn't mean that you have this expectation the same. No matter how long you've been married, if you continue to labor under some immature or false expectation of marriage, you're never going to be happy. There are four very common myths about marriage. I see these all the time when talking to people. Number one, married people expect the same things from marriage. And that's just silly. Based on your own personal upbringing, your schooling, the parental roles you had as examples, we all have different expectations of what marriage is and what marriage should be. Imagine a crisp, sunny Sunday afternoon in late September. Your father would always go outside and rake leaves on days like today. But my father would always sit by the fire with a cup of coffee and watch football games all day long. Now you're going to expect something totally different to happen on September 30th than I am. And it could be a real cause of aggravation or annoyance or problem in our marriage because of the expectations of what we think a father should do on a day like day today. The more openly you discuss your expectations of marriage, the more likely you'll develop a vision of marriage that's both of yours, as opposed to something that you just inherited from growing up. Number two, another myth that I often see is, in marriage, people think everything good in the relationship gets better. And that's just not true, right? Marriage means giving up your self-seeking lifestyle and coming to terms with new limits. Marriage often involves many unexpected inconveniences. Marriage often means accepting things that aren't as good as you would like. No matter who you fall in love with, sooner or later we fall out of love with them if the relationship continues long enough. The honeymoon always ends. We eventually come to see our partners as who they really are. A divorce attorney told me once that the number one reason people split up is they refuse to accept the fact that they're married to a human being. They enter into this marriage with these expectations of this person just being wonderful and perfect, and everything's just going to get better and better as they get married. And this letdown, this disenchantment really, you know, causes people to think, well, you know, the grass is greener over there. I can find someone who will fulfill my expectation. So everything good does not get better. This disenchantment requires you to move into deeper levels, more mature levels of intimacy. Another myth you often find is everything bad in your life disappears. No matter how good your marriage is, it's not a substitute for the difficult work of inner spiritual healing. Too often people get married to further their own well-being, not to take care of their partner's needs. The baggage you carried around with you before you were married does not get left behind on the honeymoon. Marriage can become a powerful healing agent over time, but it still requires you to do the work. The whole purpose we talked about earlier, the purpose we got married, is to find a helper suitable to help you. But that doesn't mean that automatically all the bad things in your life that you've been carrying around are going to disappear. And the last one, another myth that I often find is, it says, my spouse will make me whole. Marriage challenges us to new heights and calls us to be the best person possible, but neither marriage nor our partner will automatically make us whole. I want to talk for a minute about different kinds of relationships. There's, you know, psychologically, there's, you know, several different relationships. The first one is called an enmeshed relationship. These are characterized by a reliance on your spouse for continual support, assurance, and wholeness. These people, they depend upon the other person. These people they depend upon their partner for happiness, and they resist any kind of growth. It's usually coupled with low self-esteem and a sense of inferiority. These are the kind of people that don't think they're anything without their partner. I like to think of it as like the letter A. You know, person needs to lean upon the other person or they'll fall over. They're unable to stand on their own. Another type of relationship that's common is what's called a disengaged relationship. These relationships are the opposite of this. These are people who live separate lives together. They sleep in the same house, but they don't really share much of a life. This term reflects the isolation and independence of spouses who are attempting to earn their sense of wholeness by relying on no one. not even your own spouse. I think about the letter H. Each side is just standing up on its own. They're not understanding the concept of mutuality, the concept of sharing a life, of spending their time, you know, working with each other and building each other up. A sense of wholeness. If you want to be whole, if you want to be a real person, a healthy servant of God, you can never achieve it in either an enmeshed or a disengaged relationship. You can't achieve the maturity that Christ wants from us by leaning on your spouse and depending on your spouse for everything. But you also can't learn the lessons that Christ wants us to learn by being independent and standing apart from our spouse. Christ wants us to learn how to deal with others. Both of these are dangerous relationships to be in. Wholeness is found in what's called an interdependent relationship. It's one in which two people with self-respect make a commitment to nurture their own spiritual growth as well as that of their partners. It's more like the letter M. Each side is supported and can stand on its own, but they choose to be merged together. The second essential to a healthy marriage is a realistic understanding of love. And this is a word that just gets used, you know, way too often. We're a culture that tries to express, you know, many, many different concepts with this one word. It's helpful sometimes for us to look at maybe different cultures that have different words. We like to use the Greek. There's three different words that we use in Greek to talk about love. We're familiar with a lot of these. And these kind of three different parts make up a healthy relationship. And all of them kind of work together to form a triangle. The first one you're familiar with is eros, which is passion. Eros is the motivational side of the triangle, right? Without passion, without eros, without the sexual intimacy and the sexual drive, no man would ever get out of bed in the morning. You know, no dragons would ever get slain. This is what causes us to take energy, to take action. You know, to do. Passion is vital. It causes the relationship to grow. It's what propels us forward. You know, you never would have asked the person out in the first place if it hadn't have been for eros. But passion is self-serving unless it's linked with intimacy. Intimacy is what we know as philia. It's the emotional side of the triangle. Love without intimacy is simply hormones. Philia is the intimacy of a best friend, the intimacy of a soulmate. You have to take emotional risks to allow intimacy to live, and fear will drive it away, and no marriage can survive without it. A lack of intimacy is the number one enemy of a healthy marriage. Without intimacy, you never truly become one flesh. You never merge or bond, regardless of how much passion you have. And the last one is definitely the most important, right? Agape. Commitment. The cognitive side of the triangle. This is the love that does what it needs to do because it knows it's the right thing to do. Even if it doesn't feel it, agape does it because it knows it's right. Commitment is what secures our love for our partner. When passion burns low and when turbulent times overtakes our intimacy, it's our commitment that keeps that love alive. These three work together in this triangle. Some unhealthy triangles, I think, would include a romantic love. All passion and intimacy, but no commitment. Or a foolish love. All passion and commitment, but no intimacy. Or a companionable love. All intimacy and compassion. And commitment, but no passion. So keep all three of these parts of your relationship healthy. Cultivate the eros, the philia, and the agape in your marriage. Cultivate the passion. Ways to cultivate passion is touch. You know, practice meaningful touch. Plan mutually enjoyable experiences like date night You know, date night is a vital thing to keeping your marriage healthy, to keeping your eros, your passion alive, where you plan to go out at least once a week or once every 2 weeks on a date. Another way to cultivate your passion is to compliment your partner daily. You know, find ways to compliment them. To cultivate intimacy, you have to simply really, really listen to your partner. Listen to what they're trying to say to you. Pay attention to them. Focus on the commonalities. Explore your spiritual matters together. Cultivating commitment is probably the hardest. But to cultivate your commitment, I find it helpful to just assess the high value of the commitment. Remind yourself of the importance of the vows that you've made. Honor your partner's promise. Trust and respect them. And act in ways that respect them. It's actually helpful, you know, for a man to even, or a woman to even repeat to themselves or to their spouse their vows again and again. Cultivate that commitment. Another essential to a healthy marriage, I think, is a positive attitude and outlook toward life. Happiness in marriage has nothing to do with luck and everything to do with will. Everyone faces all kinds of troubles and trials, but the bottom line is happy couples choose to be happy. No one person can make another person unhappy. We don't believe in the supernatural devil. We don't believe that external influences cause us to sin. We believe it comes from within. And likewise, the same thing is true with happiness. There's no external influence that's going to cause you to be happy. That's something that you choose to from inside. Take responsibility for your own feelings. One of my favorite guys I'm reading lately is Viktor Frankl. He was an Austrian psychiatrist. He was captured and tortured by the Nazis. And they killed his parents, they killed his sister, and they killed his wife. After he'd lost everyone he knew and everyone he loved, he wrote, "The one thing you can't take away from me is the way I choose to respond to what you do to me. The last of one's freedoms is to choose one's abilities in any given circumstance." That's a positive outlook. It doesn't matter what's going on in my marriage. It doesn't matter, you know, what's happening. I'm going to choose to respond to it in a Christ-like, in a positive manner. Not that I'm trying to compare marriage to a concentration camp, but Frankl also said, he said, when we are no longer able to change the situation, we are challenged to change ourselves. And that's the one thing that, you know, everyone comes to grips with sooner or later if they're going to live a happy life with someone else, and that is you cannot change your spouse. You may wish for it, you may pray for it, God may bless you with some change, but the point is, the only thing you can change is yourself. You can't change your partner. You've tried for 20 years. You really only have one viable option left. Concentrate on that reality and move forward with a positive outlook. Another essential to a healthy marriage is the ability to communicate feelings. Couples report that the number one problem they face in marriage is a breakdown in communication. Men and women speak different languages. Men, I'd like you to respond to this question. When a woman says, "Do I look fat in this dress?" Every guy... I got a laser up here, you know. Every guy knows that she's not really looking for an answer to that question. Every smart guy hears, "Will you please reassure me that you still find me attractive regardless of what I have on?" That's what a smart man hears when a woman says that. When a marriage starts disintegrating, partners often conclude, "We just don't talk anymore." Actually, the non-talking is not a lack of communication. It's a very, very powerful form of negative communication. Silence is not the cause of poor communication. The fear of pain is. And people will inflict this on the other person to hurt them. The emotional pain of feeling inadequate, vulnerable, or fearful is what we are trying to avoid. True love doesn't hurt each other or use someone's confessions against them in future situations. True love doesn't hurt each other or use someone's confessions against them later in future situations. Create an environment with your spouse where you're able to freely speak to each other without condemning and criticizing each other. In an environment like this, communication will grow and not shrink. Three simple rules for successful communication. And this one I'm just now learning. Use I statements, not you statements. You statements are relationship bombs. You don't really know what the other person was thinking or what their motivations or reasons were for their actions. So instead of saying, "You are selfish," say things like, "I feel like you don't care about me when you act that way." Because you don't know what that other person really is thinking. And often, you know, they're women. They don't think the same way you think. Or they're men. They don't think the same way you think. You've, by their actions or by their statements, you've interpreted what you think they were thinking. But you're probably wrong. So it's much safer to say things about yourself than about the other person. I feel this way. It makes me feel this way when you do that or when you say that. You all know this one. Practice reflective listening. You've all sat through the workshop before, but it really does work. Reflective listening lets the other person know that you have heard what they say and you understand their message. Don't worry about whether or not you agree with it. That's the problem. People are afraid that when you're doing reflective listening, it sounds like you're agreeing with what they're saying. Simply assure them that they've been heard. The problem with men is men want to solve the problem. And really they should have been concentrating on just hearing the problem. Don't immediately switch over, stop listening, and start trying to solve it. Here's a good example. Wife. "Look at this. I just picked this dress up at the dry cleaners and there's a big stain on it. I was going to wear this dress tonight." Now, I didn't get halfway through that sentence and all the men in the room thought to themselves, "Just wear a different one." A smart husband says, "You know, I'm sorry about that. You know, I'd be upset too if I brought a dressed to the dry cleaner and paid $5 and it came back and it was still stained." They don't want you to solve it. They're not stupid. They know they got 45 other dresses hanging in the closet and they can wear any other one of those dresses. They just want you to hear and acknowledge that, you know, they're upset about what's happened. So practice that reflective listening. And the third key to good communication is communicate through touch. Physical contact is a powerful means of communicating and a gentle and supportive way to portray positive emotions. Every conversation goes better when you're sitting close and holding hands. I don't care what you're talking about. I don't care what the issue is. Put your arm around the spouse and look them in the eyes and then have that conversation. And you're going to find it's going to be dramatically different than if you were standing across the room talking to them. Sometimes arguments push people apart. One partner starts to respond negatively when trying to be touched. Push through that. And you'll find that the argument will resolve much quicker. My wife and I weren't living in the same city when we were dating, so we were unable to have pre-marriage counseling with the brother that married us. And she says, "Oh no, don't tell this story." So he had us over for dinner, and he gave us some simple, quick advice. And the first thing he said is, there's an old Jewish proverb that says, if you're having an argument, take your clothes off. If you can stand there completely naked and still yell at that person, then you know you must have a real issue. But you try it. I mean, you're not going to get half undressed and you're just going to start laughing. And you'd be rolling on the couch, busting the gut, and you're going to forget what the point of the even argument was about. What were we upset about? I don't know. But, you know, put your clothes back on. You look funny. That's what physical touch does. It just dissolves the upset. Makes the anger go away. The fifth essential to a happy marriage is acceptance of gender differences. Not only are men and women simply different, but they have different biblical roles. Psychologically, women frequently find their sense of identity through relationship with others, and men find their sense of identity through being separate. There's an inherent completeness when a man and a woman marry. One partner makes up for what the other partner lacks. But unfortunately, we too often evaluate their behavior according to our own gender-specific standards. So here you go, guys. The answer to the age-old question. Trust me, I didn't know this. I had to look it up. Three things a woman wants. Number one, to be cherished. Let your wife know that she's number one in your life. You'd rather spend time with her than anyone else. That's the one thing, the first thing she wants is to be cherished. Number two, to be understood. Let your wife know that you hear her. Her feelings are validated and accepted. You understand what she's saying. And number three, to be respected. Take your wife seriously. Honor her wishes and opinions and include her in the decision-making process. What about the guys? What is it that a man wants? I know what you're thinking. Men only want two things, sex and a sandwich. And right now, I'm not that hungry. And that's true. In a very real sense, men are much more physical in their needs. But it's also true that men are greatly affected by their emotions. Do you know that scientifically, they've actually tracked divorce. They've tracked affairs that break apart a marriage. The majority of affairs that men do are not begun because the man is not getting his physical needs met at home. The majority of the affairs are begun, believe it or not, because the man is not having his emotional needs met at home. So don't just think that us men are ignorant apes, right? You know, it's more to us than just a nice steak, right? There are more things that a man wants. Number one, a man really wants to be admired. A man wants his wife to look up to him. Men derive their worth more from what they do. Women derive their worth from who they are. Men like to be admired. When a man does not receive admiration from his spouse for the things he's done, then pretty soon he stops trying. And then she gives him even less admiration, and he does even less and less. Compliment your man. Admire him for the work and the effort he does for you, and you'll find he responds by doing even more. Number two, a man wants to have a little bit of autonomy. Unlike women, when men face stress, they generally need a little time on their own to work it out. Give them some time to decompress before asking them something. My wife learned this years ago, you know, and I come home in the day and she can sense it. You know, maybe because I've already yelled three times before I get, you know, past the front door, you know. And she just gives me a little glass of something and a little tray of crackers and cheese and says, why don't you watch the evening news and just relax while I, you know, prepare dinner. The idea of a man just needing a little time to unwind, a little time to be alone, to relax before he can address things. And that's the hard part, right? Because often the woman's been there for a while and the kids are doing crazy and you gotta line up for spankings as soon as you come in the door and all these, you know, things that have to happen and dinner's in 15 minutes and we have to barbecue and you haven't started the grill yet and, you know, so much things. But try to give that man a little bit of autonomy. The last thing is men like to enjoy shared activities. Men connect to a person emotionally by doing things together. Women connect by talking. But men, they like to achieve. They like to do something. So if you're a wife, cultivate the things that you can enjoy doing together. You know, whether it's bike riding or bowling, going for a walk or, you know, some kind of art, whatever it is that you enjoy doing together. That's how you can fulfill that man's need and desire for that. We each are different. Let's face some facts. God made us this way because he has roles he wants each one of us to fulfill. We need to appreciate that and not look for the other person to be the kind of person you are. Number six, the ability to settle arguments. Well, the good thing about marriage is that once you get married, you never have another argument again. Right? Right? Right! No, there's always going to be disagreements in every marriage. What are the top three? Top three disagreements. Number one?
Kids.
Money. By far the number one topic of discussion. Number two? Sex. And just like the discussion of money, it often revolves around quantity. Right? And number three? In-laws. I'm not going to go there today, okay? The key to a good marriage is not to think that you can somehow miraculously avoid ever fighting. You can't. You're going to have fights. The key to a healthy marriage is to learn how to fight a fair fight. Here's five suggestions on how to fight a fair fight. First, don't run from it. Don't run from strife. If you try to avoid it, what happens, it just gets worse. When you bottle it up, pretty soon, now 3 weeks later, you're blowing up because of the ketchup bottle. And it really is not because of the ketchup bottle. It's because of 34 other things in the past month that you've just allowed to bottle up and bottle up and bottle up. Don't let that happen. Address things quickly. Don't let the sun go down on your wrath. And number two, choose your battles carefully. Some things should be changed, and some things should simply be overlooked. I was telling my wife yesterday, the hardest thing for me is realizing that, how do I say it? That if it's not important enough for me to actually want to talk to you about it and address it, then it must be something I need to just deal with, right? So if what you're doing, something silly, something trivial, you're constantly leaving the toilet seat up, okay? Let's pretend that's a problem in some houses, right? Constantly doing this. You know, if it really is trivial and silly, and I don't feel it's important enough for us to have a fight over, then I need to just deal with it. Choose your battles carefully. Some things you really should have a talk about, But some things, just need to simply overlook them, be the bigger person, be mature, let it go by. Number three, define the issue clearly. Don't get 45 minutes into your fight and then say, what is it we were fighting about? Clearly define what the problem is and stay on the topic. Just sit down and say, we need to talk about this. This is what we're going to talk about. And don't start bringing in all the other things and all the other examples from other issues. State your feelings directly. Again, use I statements instead of you statements. Let them know what is bothering you. I feel like this is not fair because you do this, and here we go, right? And number five, give up on the put-downs. Don't make it personal. You know more about this person than anybody else, and you know what hurts them more than anything anybody else. So be careful what you say, fatso. Number seven, a common spiritual foundation and goal. Marrying someone in the truth is only half the battle because no one stays the same person they were on their wedding day. You both need to develop in the truth together. Invest time to make sure that the soul of your marriage, the foundation of your marriage, matures as you both do. God designed us with this aching, this longing, this soul thirsting to be made complete. And marriage can make that longing soul feel better for a while, but it can only be truly satisfied with a healthy relationship with God. Each one of you needs to grow and mature and strengthen your relationship with God. You'll feel incomplete and unsatisfied no matter what marriage you're in, unless you've found fulfillment in your fellowship with Christ and with God. So cultivate that as a couple, and you'll both feel better about each other. Three things to cultivate your spiritual foundation. One, worship together. Always go together and be together around the Lord's table. Whenever we break bread, I want to be holding my wife's hand. Serve together. Find a service or ministry that you can give to the Lord. We can do together. You know, we work on the project together, and then we go to these meetings together. It's something that it's a service that you can give to God and can share. And pray together. At least once a day. Take the energy. Get on your knees side by side. A healthy marriage takes effort and energy. It doesn't just happen. Cultivate these seven essentials and your marriage will reap the benefits, the rewards. Cultivate a healthy expectation of marriage, a realistic understanding of love, a positive outlook, a positive attitude and outlook toward life, the ability to communicate feelings, an understanding and acceptance of gender differences, and the ability to make decisions and settle arguments, and a common spiritual foundation and goal. And I just want to leave you with some wonderful words from 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 3. He says, "The same goes for you wives. Be good wives to your husbands, responsive to their needs. There are husbands who, indifferent as they are to any words about God, will be captivated by your life of holy beauty. What matters is not your outer appearance, the styling of your hair, the jewelry you wear, or the cut of your clothes, but your inner disposition. Cultivate inner beauty, the gentle, gracious kind that God delights in. The holy women of old were beautiful before God that way and were good, loyal wives to their husbands. Sarah, for instance, taking care of Abraham, would address him as, 'My dear husband.' You'll be true daughters of Sarah if you do the same, unanxious and unintimidated. And the same goes for you husbands. Be good husbands to your wives. Honor them, delight in them. As women, they lack some of your advantages, but in the new life of God's grace, you're equals. Treat your wives then as equals, so your prayers don't run aground." And verse 8, summing up, be agreeable, be sympathetic, be loving, be compassionate, be humble. Amen.